Well, we want to first start off and just hear, how did you become a Christian? If you share your testimony with us.
Wow, yeah. It was not in my plans at all. I probably started using drugs for the first time when I was 14 years old. By the time I was 16, even my friends who were pretty heavy drug users said, hey, you probably ought to slow down. You're doing way too much speed. And by the time I was 18 years old, I had sold marijuana, amphetamines, Quaaludes, and LSD. If you get caught selling LSD, first offense, it's federal, is 25 years to life. 25 years to life. First time. And, you know, I didn't think about any of those things because I was always high. And it didn't bother me that it was illegal. It didn't bother me that it was supposedly bad for you, dangerous, any of a number of other things. I liked it because it felt really, really good. It made me feel really good physically. It made me feel really good mentally, emotionally, psychologically, things like that. I had a nice family. I was raised by good people. I had everything in life you could want. We were kind of upper middle class. Everything was great. It was stable. It was happy, so on and so forth in human terms. In real terms, in spiritual terms, I was not happy. I was miserable. I did not find any kind of deep meaning in life, although I knew there had to be something somewhere. I did martial arts for many years, so I got into kind of a weird combination of Zen Buddhism and acid trips. And I used to actually sit with some other people in front of Buddha doing, you know, Zen meditation, you know, sitting still for an hour and a half with your back straight up. And I had gotten myself so heavily into drugs that it was very difficult for me to function without it. For me, it was kind of a release, a vacation. And I had no work ethic. I was a pathological liar. I was incredibly lazy. And I thought I was the least selfish, most humble, most wonderful guy on the planet, when in fact I was incredibly selfish, incredibly arrogant, and a jerk, to use a charitable post-conversion word for myself. And I had probably been to church once or twice a year, you know, Christmas, Easter, that kind of American traditional Christianity thing. Been to church a few times, and I remember I would sit in church and I'd hear people sing, and I'd hear someone go up front and read from this book, and what are they doing? Everyone knows this isn't real. And I remember, sometimes as a young kid, sometimes as an older teenager, sitting in church, and again, this is very rare, once or twice a year at the most, sitting in church and saying, you know what, if you're real, I dare you to try and do something to me. I mean, I was just challenging God. I was just shaking my fist. There's no God. This is a bunch of bunk. This isn't real. And then, of course, nothing happened, and I took that as proof. I took that as proof of the non-existence of God instead of proof of his incredible forbearance and patience with me. And then, when I was 18 years old, I went off to college, one of the notorious party schools in Maryland, Frostburg State. You lived in Columbia, right? So you know where Frostburg is, one of the party schools. And so I went there, and that's all I did. I didn't go to class. I didn't read my books. I just stayed in my dorm room, and I got high, and I sold stuff to other people. And there was a weekend when I and two of my friends got a massive, massive amount of hard liquor, a quarter pound of pot, a bunch of LSD, a lot of LSD and speed, and we just went around, and we were using it all, but we were also selling it. And it took me about 3 days to come down from that weekend. And I had, just a few days before, met the young lady who's sitting in the back there. You may have difficulty spotting her, because she'll blend in with everyone else with the blonde hair. And the round eyes, you know. And I had met her maybe a week before this, and she was a track runner for the university, for the college, and was gone on a weekend, you know, track meet with my friends, because she was really cute and I really liked her, and I told her, you know, I was really into her. She says, well, I can't really date you. You're not a Christian. My response was, well, of course I'm a Christian. I'm an American, for crying out loud. What do I look like? Confucianist? What are you talking about? And so she, well, here, you need to read this. And she and a couple of her friends got this little, like, $3 cheap Bible and handed it to me. He said, you need to read this. And yeah, whatever. And so she was gone. I went on this crazy LSD trip for several days. She came back, and I was in my dorm room, and I was utterly miserable with myself. I was utterly, my life had no meaning. There was no sense in it. And I was very, very, very deeply unhappy and terribly lonely. I was not a happy guy. And I picked up the Bible, and I opened to Genesis, because that's the beginning. I was an English major. I never went to class, but I had vague ideas about literature, you know. And you open the beginning. So I open it up. I'm like, okay, in the beginning, God created the heavens and earth. Okay, I know that part. Chapter 2, okay, yeah, God divides the land and the earth. And then the fourth day, oh, there's the creation of man. Yeah, I know that part. And Eve from Adam. Yeah, I remember hearing that when I was a little kid. And I kind of flip through, and then I get to chapter 3. I'm like, oh, here's the part with the snake and the apple and Eve. And then I read a little bit further. None of this is making a lot of sense to me. And then there's this whole God's really upset with them. He says, it's a piece of fruit. What's the big deal? Fruit's healthy. What's the problem with the fruit? And then I get to chapter 4, where the older brother and the younger brother get into a fight, and the one kills the other. Now, that I could identify with, because I had two really annoying younger brothers. So that one, okay, that's pretty cool. And then I get halfway through chapter 4, and all of a sudden I'm like, wait a minute. Lamech and Mahushael and Enoch and Irad, and this one begat that one, and so on and so on. And I'm like, this is exactly what I thought the Bible was. This is a bunch of dead Jewish people. I don't know who these people are. I do not care. And so I thought, no, this is no good. And so I thought, well, I'll flip to this other part. I didn't know anything about the difference between the New Testament and the Old Testament. And I open up, I'll try some of this New Testament stuff, right? And so I open up to Matthew, right? And I'm trying to read through the first chapter of Matthew. And the first thing I find in Matthew is another one of these lists of dead people. I don't know who any of these people are. What is all that? What is this? Is the list of dead people? What's going on here? And it made no sense to me at all. And I got very frustrated with it. And then I made the fatal mistake of flipping forward. I didn't know what was what in the Bible. I made the fatal mistake of flipping open to the beginning of the Gospel of John. Now, you have to understand, I've never really ever heard the Gospel before. I didn't really grow up in church. I had vague ideas about, the first book of the Bible is Genesis, and the last one is Revelation. There's something about the Antichrist in there. And the book of Psalms, I didn't know what that was about. My grandmother, so Scottish Presbyterian lady, she had Bibles all over the house, and they always had these beautiful photographs. And I remember as a little kid, I opened to the Psalms, and there was a picture of a palm tree in the desert in Israel. And I thought, those guys aren't very good proofreaders. They don't know how to spell palm, right? That was the extent of my knowledge of the Bible, right? And Jesus, I've kind of got some vague ideas about him. The Holy Ghost, that was, well, didn't they kill him on a cross? But then his spirit came like up out of the grave or something. Is that the Holy Ghost? Literally, I had no experience with the Bible or theology at all. Nothing. Total ignorance. And you have to remember, I have been frying my brains with 20,000 volts every weekend with illegal pharmaceuticals. And I begin to read the Gospel of John, and I freaked out. I could not understand. Here, I'm an English major. I'm supposed to be good at interpreting things. I just kept reading it over and over. The beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, the same as the beginning. And he made everything. Wait, what is this? And I completely freaked out. And all of a sudden, I was overwhelmed with a vision of myself as not what I thought I was. I wasn't unselfish. I wasn't humble. I wasn't a good guy. I was hideously selfish. And I had all these images of myself lying to my mother, lying to my father, and being selfish with candy bars, and lying when someone said they needed a dollar to borrow, and stealing things, right? And breaking things. And my parents telling me, never play with matches. So I immediately went out and played with matches. Everything that I wasn't supposed to do, I was doing them. And then I was covering up that I was doing them because I had a conscience, a little one, really small one. And I realized that what was being described as I flipped through the Gospel of John was was me, that I was a sinful human being, that I was not just kind of bad, kind of good mix, that I was really bad, that I was selfish, that I was miserable as a result, and that there was a God that I didn't know anything about, but all of a sudden I understood he was massive and holy and terrifying and hated my sin and had every reason to destroy me, and I was very frightened by that. I was actually very frightened, and I just saw what it would be like to stand in front of this God who I still had no real comprehension of and try to give an account of myself. And I realized I can lie to everyone around me and fool some of them some of the time, but I will never be able to get this by God. And without even understanding what the gospel was, but looking at the gospel of John, I started to cry out to God and I said, I don't even know if I can believe in you, but I'm willing to be willing if you'll help me. I didn't say show me or perform a miracle. I said, can you show me who you are? And then I just started flipping through the Bible and I found out who Jesus was and I started crying, and I didn't even understand what conversion was, you understand. I didn't even know you were supposed to be converted, be born again, and it happened to me. Yeah, and this is February of 1983. And at that point, I lost all my desire and taste for, the drugs and stopped. You know, I kind of became an annoying Jesus freak running around telling everyone, no, you got to don't take the LSD. Let's read this. And that was, 34 years ago. Came totally out of the blue. Unexpected, not looking for it, not hoping for it, not even wanting it. Didn't even know what it was.
I think that just really goes to show, you know, just how God is the one who orchestrates these things. I mean, I think it's interesting because, I think most of us, well, pretty much all of us, maybe some of you have only known of him as of like 30 minutes ago. But all we know is the professor at Masters kind of guy, you know, and I think I've heard you share your testimony once before, and you go, wow, like here's someone that God is truly saved, like you said, it's not because he went looking for it, and it's just such a wonderful testimony, that God is merciful in that way. Well, one of the things I also asked if you could share is how did you meet your wife? You did share that you met her initially, and what happened?
Yeah, it was the week before, reading the Bible. Maybe it might have been a couple of days, might have been a week, maybe no more than 10 days, and I was, 18 and desperately trying to look sophisticated to impress women at the college, I knew nothing about being sophisticated other than how to look like a guy that was 18 trying to fake looking sophisticated. And, I had what I thought was a sheepskin jacket, a real sheepskin jacket, which she later pointed out to me was actually made out of 100% acrylic, from the boys' department at Sears. She pointed out the tag and said, well, acrylic is actually Latin for sheep, No. We had these, it's a secular school, so we were always having these crazy drunken parties, and I would go out and try and look sophisticated. Somehow or another, I had probably seen a James Bond movie or something, and I knew that if you put something brown and semi-opaque in a glass that you held like this and swirled around, like brandy, I think is what I had, and you were that would make you sophisticated. I took a test. Wow, this is absolutely tastes terrible, but it looks really sophisticated. So I remember I walk out to this party, and everyone's drinking a $2 a case beer because they're college students and they're all laying on the ground. And one of the young ladies that lived on the other side of the door, because we had these kind of co-ed pods, this is very radical in 1982, 83, there was guys and girls in the same wing of the dorm, slightly different areas. And so we had this community area, and there was a girl from across the way, and she brought her friend, and I was like, wow, man, she's really cute, that girl is so pretty. But she was so young looking, I thought, I can't ask her for a date because someone's going to think all kinds of terrible things because she looked like she was 14 years old, but she was so pretty. And then we got into a conversation. I found out she was actually a college senior, but very baby face, very pretty. And we started getting into a conversation. And this is really the story that she likes to tell. But tonight she's sitting back there, so I'll tell it. And so she saw me sitting there and probably saw, because she's very perceptive, saw right through the fake sophistication stuff, right? And, considering the fact that all sophistication is actually fake, My fake sophistication was doubly fake. It was like fake, you know, with a, you know, superscript 2, double, you know, fake squared. And so I'm sitting there in my fake sheepskin jacket and my brandy. It's, I didn't know how to drink and all that stuff. And she just comes over and she's like, so who are you? What's your story? You know, she's very outgoing. I actually tend to be a very much an introvert. I'm a professor, so I talk in front of people for a living all the time. But we'll have a party at my own house, and I just sit in the corner and don't talk. I just tend to be very, like, this is slightly awkward for me until I get to know people. And so she said, so who are you? What's your story? What are you up to? And I actually said, now she thinks I should be embarrassed by this. My favorite band when I was growing up was Pink Floyd. I liked that weird kind of strange intellectual acid rock type stuff. That's what I like to listen to. And I still think that they're a phenomenally talented bunch of musicians. They're a little crazy and big drug problems and stuff. So I just looked her right in the eye and I gave her my best line, which was, all you need to know about me is I like Pink Floyd. And that just slayed her right on the spot. She got her on her knees, asked me to marry her right then. Well, no, that's not actually what happened. She just burst into laughter. So I realized, okay, that line didn't really work. But I had another line, right? This is Frostburg out in Western Maryland in the mountains. It's very cold. It's always snowing there in the wintertime. And so after some conversation, we're kind of standing there, and there's this huge window, and I'm staring, and there's this beautiful snow falling down very slow, the huge flakes, and and she comes up and goes, oh, yeah, look at that. And I'm like, yeah, look at that beautiful snow, really cold night, very crisp and cold. It's a beautiful night. It is a beautiful night. It'd be a gorgeous night for a walk. I love walking in the snow. There's a forest around us. Don't you love walking in the snow? Snow walking is great. Walking in general is great. Snow is great, but walking in the snow, walking in general is great. Snow is really good. I like snow. Have you ever walked in the snow? Snow, you want to go? So that was the slide. So we went for a walk in the snow, and I was completely smitten, as well I should have been. And it was about a week after that, no more than 2 weeks, that I was actually converted. And I went over to her dorm room, and she had given me the Bible and had answered a couple of simple questions that I'd asked her. And I said, you know, I think I just started to be a Christian or something like that. And then she started asking me some more serious questions, because that could just be like leverage to get a date, you know? And she started asking me questions. I started asking her questions. You have to understand, I knew nothing. I was like, all right, so this part when Jesus is talking with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, what's their problem? Because they have this terrible attitude, and he seems really cool to me, right? And I don't know anything about anything at all. And I'm like, now, where's the part about the ark, you know? Because I saw the movie with Harrison Ford, and I thought that was really cool. I just didn't understand how they got all those animals inside the ark. I had no conception of anything about the Bible and theology. So that's how we met. And then, you know, about a year later, we got married, which on her part was very risky, because I was a very new convert. I was still having LSD flashbacks about 2 years into marriage. Yeah. So that was kind of risky on her part. Not on my part. At all.
Yes. Maybe you can share a little bit about your family. Mm-hmm. You have some children. You share a little bit about your family life and what excites you about your family.
3 weeks from now will be our 33rd wedding anniversary. One girl during that whole time. Thank you. That's very handy. Makes things work out very nice. And my wife has just been a continual blessing in my life during that time. Very forbearing, very patient, very gracious, and a whole lot of fun. I will tell her, and I also will tell this kind of thing to people publicly. I'll say, you know, every now and then I want to kill you, but I'm never bored. And that might be, and I know she feels the same way about me, although it might be reversed. She might want to kill me all the time, but she's never interested. I don't know. But we got married, and a year and a half later, we had our first child. I got married when I was 19, and I had my first child when I was 21, just turned 21. And He is now 31 years old. He's a paramedic. He lives with his wife, who he met at the college, who's an international student. She's kind of European-Canadian, lives with her parents up in Canada, in Alberta, right at the base of the Rockies. And they have a little boy who is 2.5, and twin girls that are 9 months, 8 months. And then our middle son, Josiah, and he and the oldest boy also went to Masters, where he met his wife. Middle son, Josiah, is 28 and 29. Oh, 29. Oh, that means I'm getting old. 29. That's right. He did just have a birthday, which meant I just had a birthday at the same, oh, a month apart. So he's 29. He also married an international student. She is from Uganda. She's from Kampala, Uganda. So she grew up in a Pentecostal family in Uganda. And so, you know, she kind of came into our family, and then we got to know her family, and they're just lovely, lovely Christian people. And I've actually been to Uganda. We had a big kind of traditional East African ceremony over there, and then I performed the wedding for Josiah and Linda when they came back here in the summer. He has taught at the college level. He actually now works at a classical school teaching rhetoric and philosophy. She's an accountant. Is she 27 or 28? She's slightly younger than him. She's recently 28, and not even 30 yet, and she runs the financials for Aetna nationally. Like, she's always on conference calls with the CFO for Aetna, which is the biggest insurance company in America, I think, or maybe the second biggest. I don't even understand. Like, accounting just kind of, you know, goes over. I don't understand that kind of, but she's a brilliant, wonderful girl. They have two adorable little kids. They have a little two-year-old boy and a little boy that is almost one. And then I have, Joanne and I have a daughter, one daughter, and she just turned 23, and she's in a fifth year at Masters. She's just kind of doing the long, slow time, because she loves the college, loves the university. And she's an English major, just like my middle son was. And is just kind of a real delight. She's a real scholar and academic, wants to go to grad school, wants to be a teacher. So that's my family.
Great. Maybe you share also a little bit about what you do now, and both in terms of your teaching, but maybe also some of the hobbies and things. I know
we've
had some of that in the blurb there.
Okay, yeah. Well, I am a literature professor, which basically means I'm a professional nerd, right? I get paid to have fun. I get paid to read books, to talk to really interesting, fun, smart students like your own daughters, and to write and to publish and travel around and speak and talk and do things like that. It's completely bizarre, John, that the guy that's the extreme introvert has done like 100 radio shows and 10 or 15 TV shows, because that I would never in a million, like, I get embarrassed if I go into the bathroom, I see myself in the mirror, you know, I'm extremely overly self-conscious, self-aware nerd. And so I've taught at the college or university level now since 1994. I've taught at University of Alabama. I worked at UNC Chapel Hill, which is kind of like the Berkeley of the East Coast. Big, huge, wild, crazy research university. Extremely crazy liberal. Very, very, very good students. Incredible place academically. I worked at Duke University, which is right down the road in North Carolina, for a while. And then came to Masters in 1999. And coming from the East Coast in the Mid-South, Southern California was complete and total culture shock. In every kind of way, not entirely negatively, but it was just so different. He's really cute. It was just so entirely strange and different for us that it took us a while to get used to it. You know, it's kind of like, all right, so the tax system, but the weather, kind of thing. So you can be outside all the time; it's always beautiful, but then they take all your money. So we've lived in Santa Clarita, where the Masters College, now university, is. My training was actually for teaching graduate students. I decided I didn't want to do that. I decided I really like the college age better than teaching graduate students. And so I teach British literature. That's my specialty. So I do guys like Shakespeare and John Donne and Ben Jonson, the early kind of medieval Renaissance guys. My specialty is John Milton. Has anybody in here even heard of him other than some of the people? Oh, good. All right. There is hope for the culture. John Milton is the famous Puritan writer who, among many other things, wrote Paradise Lost, this marvelous, gigantic, epic poem about the fall of Satan and the fall of Adam and Eve and the redemption in Christ and so on and so forth. It's very, very beautiful, very difficult. I will go ahead and say it and embarrass your daughter, but Jenna Kim wrote the single best undergraduate paper on John Milton that I have read in all these decades of teaching. She is a wonderful student, very, very hardworking. Yes, you can clap for her. It was actually so good that I sent it. I got to the end, and the first thing I did was I wrote to my friend Michael Ward at Oxford University, who is the world's leading C.S. Lewis scholar and also a big fan of Milton. I said, "You have to read this paper by one of my undergraduates. You're going to believe this is amazing." And he wrote back, This is quite sharp indeed, you know, the British language. Only 5 bibliographical errors, but other than that, you know. Lovely, lovely paper. Anyways, and every time I see him, what is she doing now? I don't know, something amazing somewhere, I'm sure. It's really cool. So I teach courses on Shakespeare. I teach courses on John Milton. I teach a course on John Calvin. I teach courses on classical Christian humanism in the 16th, 17th century, and a whole lot of other things. I teach film studies. I teach art history. I've started a program that Masters has where we'll be living in Italy, in Florence, with students for the summer and teaching them a bunch of humanities courses over there. Along the way, a lot of very strange things have happened that I would not have expected. About a decade ago, I got involved in the classical Christian education movement. Now I work with a think tank that's kind of leading the whole movement academically, with hundreds of these marvelous classical schools where we teach the students, Latin and Greek and all the classical, pedagogical methodology, and really, really learning Bible and theology and church history, things like that. Like we teach Homer to 7th graders and Plato to 8th graders, so when they get to John Calvin in the 10th grade, they understand his kind of Platonizing Christian Reformed theology. Another thing that I never would have thought happened is I got contacted by the head of Fuller Seminary in Pasadena, which is wildly liberal, crazy, crazy, crazy liberal. And he said, "Would you come teach here?" And I'm like, "Did you look me up? Do you know that John MacArthur is my boss? And he's basically placed an anathema on your entire seminary." So anyways, we went out to lunch, and he said, "I think it would be great to have a really conservative evangelical guy on your campus." I said, "Do you think that I'm going to just burst into flames when I walk?" And so I teach. Here's the ironic thing. Here's a guy from the South who used to sell drugs, then became a Latin scholar, and now teaches Latin, the Catholic language, to liberal people at a seminary. That's the strange kind of turning roads that God will put you on. Crazy. So that's what I do is far work. And I've written a couple of books. You can find them on Amazon.com and buy them, and I'll get like 8 cents per book and stuff like that. But
one of the books that you wrote is on movies. Mm-hmm. And maybe if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about why did you write that book and how it might be helpful.
In the ancient world, ancient Greece and Rome, sculpture, architecture, epic poetry, and classical tragedy are the forms of art. That's the serious high art. That's how the culture expresses itself. Culture is just what people believe and what they value and what they produce to remind themselves of what they believe and value. And they produce these things that they will enjoy, things that are pretty to look at, shows that are interesting to watch, buildings that are pleasant to live in or to walk through, these kinds of things. Everything from gardening to Michelangelo's David. And that culture doesn't remain static. So when you get into the Middle Ages, the primary art form is cathedral building. And they fill the cathedrals with paintings and the sculptures. But the cathedral is kind of the highest expression of medieval European culture. You get into the Renaissance and the invention of printing and the recovery of all the lost knowledge of the Greeks and the Romans, the printing of Latin and Greek books. Then writing, texts become almost entirely central. You get into the 17th century, painting comes roaring back, and you have guys like Vermeer and so on and so forth. And in the 19th century, at least in Europe, is the invention of the novel. right? At the same time, people become very interested in how human psychology works, how complex and deep the human mind is when you have the rise of the novel. So you get these gigantic stories, as long as epic poems by Homer from 2,000 years ago, and these very deep, complex portrayals of human psychological reaction to what's going on around you. Everything changes in the 20th century. And now, the primary vehicle of culture, the values, the ideas, the aesthetic values, it's in movies. Stop and think about it. Since the 1920s, film actually begins in the 1890s. A lot of people don't know that. But filmmaking becomes a viable, productive business, culture business, starting in the 1920s. So for nearly a century, virtually everybody on the planet that has any access to technology at all, and that's the vast majority of people now, the vast majority of people right now get all of their ideas and all of their opinions and all of their values from movies. And I don't know if you've ever walked around in Hollywood, but that's a little scary. Hollywood, 15 minutes, 20 minutes from my house, is the cultural production capital of the entire planet. There are more people alive on Earth now than every other human being combined. There are so many people. And everyone gets their ideas. Everyone gets their ideas about justice, their ideas about romance, their ideas oftentimes about God and spiritual things. They get their ideas about human nature. They get their aesthetics from movies. And very few Christians have written about film in a way that is both appreciative of the art aspects and the cultural aspects and the narrative aspects, and also approached it from a conservative, evangelical, and I would say biblical, theological point of view. Some people say, oh, movies are really cool, and some of them, they cuss too much. Okay, so don't watch those movies. And other ones are like, the gospel is in every movie. Superman, he's like Jesus. Well, that's a really bad analogy. Flunked out of logic class, did you? Right? And then other people will say, everything goes. You know, a Christian, you know, to the pure, all things are pure, and you know, you can watch anything, and that's probably not a good idea. And then some people will say, you should never watch any kind of movie, you shouldn't read books, anything produced by humans or pagans at all has no value, it's nothing that's dangerous, but you can make a very strong biblical case against that, which is what I do in the book. So essentially what I did there was I developed a theory about the origins of culture from the suppression of truth. It's not particularly complicated. You can read it in the opening chapter of the book. The idea is, why is it that human beings produce any kind of cultural material at all? All you need is food, clothing, shelter, water. A little sunshine is nice. That's why we like Southern California, right? I mean, our actual needs are very, very basic. Companionship is good, but you can survive without it, right? So why do we have opera? Why does Homer produce the Iliad and the Odyssey, right? Why do we have Shakespeare plays and sonnets? Why do we have situation comedies like All in the Family in the 1970s, right? Why do we have scary radio shows back in the 1940s, right? Why do we have 19th century novels that seem to stretch out to the crack of doom like most things by Tolstoy, right? And I happen to like Tolstoy. So why do human beings do that? And I think that we produce those things because we have, according to Romans chapter 1, suppressed the truth of who God is, suppressed the truth about ourselves, suppressed the truth about the fact that he's the author, the designer, the creator of the world and everything in it, including us, that he is the judge of those who reject him. We have suppressed the truth about goodness and truth and beauty and love and holiness and justice. We have suppressed all this truth. That's what Romans 1 says, that all the things about God and everything about his making of the world is clearly visible. He even says, the invisible things are clearly seen, which doesn't, you ever notice how crazy the Bible actually is? Sometimes you look at it like, wait a minute, the invisible things are clearly seen? You see, it's not the Bible that's messed up, it's us. We think the invisible things clearly seen, that's crazy. No, what's crazy is that we have eyes and can't see. We have ears and can't hear. We have a tongue we can't taste. And so when Paul says that in Romans chapter 1, verses 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, kind of culminating in 22, professing themselves wise, they became fools. I think what Paul is doing, and remember, Romans is at the very beginning of the theological teaching of the New Testament. You've got the four Gospels and the book of Acts, which are kind of history books, right? And then the first part of Scripture in the New Testament that is teaching propositional theology, theological arguments, the first thing Paul says is, the first thing human beings have done after the fall is suppress the truth. It's the number one fact about human beings. And if you don't understand that, then you're not going to understand anything, right? And so because human beings have suppressed the truth, what I think we've done is that truth is kind of like water. You can compress air. You've seen compressed air tanks. But you can't compress water. Water is incompressible, right? And in a similar fashion, you can't take any matter, whether it's compressible or not, and make the matter go away. You can't take a whole bunch of carbon or hydrogen or thallium or anything else and make it go away. Now, you can split certain kinds of atoms, but then you go away because you have a thermonuclear event. All right? Okay? Matter doesn't go away. And water is not compressible. And I think that is a truth in the physical universe that God has built in there to demonstrate his truth about truth. Truth never goes away. And if you read pagans like Shakespeare, who has great lines like, truth will out! And at the end of his plays, the bad guys always get caught, right? Or you read pagans like Sigmund Freud, who says that we're filled with all of these things deep down inside that we've repressed. Or pagans like German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who says, there is no truth, and truth is just the fact that we've forgotten that there's no truth, and we are actually controlled by an unconscious, subconscious mind that contains everything that we've repressed, and now it's all trying to come back out. Even pagans recognize that we've suppressed a tremendous amount of truth. And if we have, in fact, suppressed truth, it is actually going to come back out. It's going to bubble out. It's going to squirt out. It's going to squeeze out. It's going to escape through the gaskets. And I think those are the things that drive human culture. So if you watch a movie that deals with the question of justice and absolute right and wrong, good and evil, you have to ask yourself, well, if a bunch of liberals in Hollywood scripted it, directed it, did the cinematography and produced it and edited and distributed it, why do they have a story that has the idea of justice and absolute truth if they don't believe in it? Everybody wants the good guys to win. No one in Star Wars roots for Darth Vader. Yeah, Darth, kill them all. We want the Empire to win. Die, Luke. No one says that, right? When Darth Vader walks in, dun, 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 no one's going, yay! No, when Luke swoops in and blows up the Death Star, that's when everybody cheers. Because everybody wants the good side to win. Everybody wants to be on the good side. And everybody recognizes that there's a split between good and evil. And then we've suppressed the truth that, in fact, we're evil. And we are not on the good side. And so I treat a whole bunch of movies in a bunch of different genres, and I show how the things that are in movies, even that are pagan ideas, are actually showing the truth about what God says about human nature.
So next time you watch a movie, there's a lot more going on that you can think about. And I hope you really consider that. You know, I think sometimes we get so passive in the thought process that we don't realize that, I mean, especially as Christians who have been given truth, you know, we don't work with that. And so, I mean, I love movies too. You know, my girls, you know, we quote movie lines all the time, you know, and it goes to show just how much it impresses upon our thinking. You know, it kind of sticks in there, but there's a lot more going on that maybe we need to consider. Maybe just a couple more quick questions. Tell us a little bit about your climbing. Why do you do that?
God made mountains. They're like a natural playground. or as teachers would always write on my papers, be specific. So if you want me to be a little bit more specific?
Sure.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I've been involved in rock climbing, ice climbing, alpine mountaineering, and big wall climbing in Yosemite 38 years. You know, people come up to me in the climbing gym, and they're all half my age and younger, and they're like, you're really old. What are you doing in here? Trying to keep up with these young kids, and so on and so forth. And they're like, how long have you been climbing? And I'm like, have you ever heard of a guy named Jimmy Carter? When he was the president, that's when I started climbing. It was actually in the 70s. And I've kind of done everything there is to do in the world of climbing in general. I climbed really hard stuff in the 80s, 90s, and in the early 2000s, kind of like world-class level stuff. I'm not an adrenaline junkie. I do not like being scared. Being scared is part of climbing, and you have to learn how to control the emotion, but I don't do it to be scared. I'm not interested in danger. I'm not like, oh, let's, you know, push it right to the envelope, to the edge. Yeah, I've been in some scary situations, but I don't look for them, and I really, really try and stay. I mean, I've done climbs in this era where I have run 15 miles, then climbed a glacier, and then gone up a 3,000-foot face, and I'm only 200 feet from the summit of the mountain, and I look over the ridge, and I see a storm coming. I'm like, time to go home, and down I go. Because I'm, you know, I mean, I have a wife that I love and family, and I'm not going to do something stupid. There's nobody, you know, it's like, you know, I mean, that would be like wandering out onto the 405 during rush hour. Why would you do that? Right? You can mitigate a tremendous percentage of the danger in climbing by following certain kinds of rules. One of my friends who used to climb years and years ago and is a professor at Masters, Greg Beely, Dr. Beely, he repeats this phrase that all the old climbers say: there are old climbers and there are bold climbers, but there are no old bold climbers. Yeah. So you have to have sense. So how many of you have been to Yosemite Valley? Right? Yeah, okay, good. I have students, and they like live in Fresno. It's like, oh, you go to Yosemite all the time. Yeah, I never drove up there. It's supposed to be really, I'm like, what? There's like 900 million visitors a year to Yosemite Valley. It's a traffic jam. It looks like West LA on a Friday afternoon in Yosemite in June. It's just a terrible place to go in the summer. But the gigantic walls in there that were first climbed in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The really big one on the left is El Capitan, right? You guys know that? It's a gigantic cliff on the left. It is, you have to picture three Empire State Buildings stacked up vertically. One, two, three. And then the top one, lean it over about like that. That's what El Capitan is like. And the first ascent, which is in 1958, took 48 days of climbing, spread over a year and a half of attempts. They just kept pushing it higher and higher and higher and leaving the ropes up there and rappelling down and then going back up. And it literally took them a year and a half. And the Park Service finally said, you have a couple more days to finish this or we're never going to let you go back on there. Everyone said it was completely impossible. They finally topped out in 1958, and it took several years before it was repeated, and it took this very strong team of climbers a week to do it. Most people now who climb El Capitan take a very fast team will do it in 2.5 days. That's very, very considered very, very fast. And the average team will take 5 days to a week. There are some climbs that will actually take 10 days or even longer to do, especially a first ascent on. When I've been on El Capitan and passed teams that have been up there for 5 days. And what I do, there's a small group of us that have been climbing for a pretty long time, and we do a special set of techniques called speed climbing, which is basically like, instead of running a long, slow distance ultra marathon, you know, running a 50-mile race, you're sprinting it. And it involves different kinds of physical climbing techniques and a certain pretty high level of fitness. And the goal is to climb El Capitan in under 24 hours. And I've done that 4 times now. According to the guy that keeps the record, I'm the only person in the world who ever walked up to El Capitan, never been to Yosemite before, never climbed El Capitan before, never tried it, and did it in less than 1 day on a first attempt. So, and that was like one of those magical days where everything kind of came together perfectly. You know, right now I'm really sore because I went to the climbing gym for 3 hours last night and my arms hurt too much to lift. You know, so you have the up days and the down days. But that's what I do. That's what I do to relax.
Yeah, I think some of us don't understand that.
I don't understand. I never said I understood it. You know, but yeah.
I mean, we go to the Czech Republic, and then when they tell us that we're going to go on a hike, and I get depressed just when they say that. And it's not, and they kind of water it down for us Americans. Yeah. Well, maybe you can give us a little bit of a preview for the weekend.
As, sure.
I've shared with our church the theme that you presented, Ecclesiastes, the most unbiblical book in the Bible. And I think when I first said that, everyone looked at me like, what?
You can see that my tongue is right here inside of my cheek, okay? Yeah, because I, you know, right. Yeah, Ecclesiastes is one of my very favorite books of the Bible. And I've been kind of writing a book on it in my head for years. I haven't actually written anything down other than some notes. Maybe someday. I'm working on some other stuff right now. When you tell people that you like the book of Ecclesiastes, they want to get you a Prozac prescription. They think you must be depressive or you know, maybe a little weird or bipolar or this or that. You know, the guy must have problems. You're supposed to like the Psalms and the Proverbs and, you know, the Gospel of Luke and the Christmas story and things like that. And you tell people that you really love Ecclesiastes and you've read it over and over. I spent a year at my church teaching all the way through Ecclesiastes. This was a number of years ago. And I've done it several times since. And I think that the reason I became fascinated with Ecclesiastes was I started reading it when I was a very young Christian. I had been a believer maybe a year or two, and I had a little teeny Bible. I was working on a dairy farm, and I would clean a barn, take an hour, and then I'd get like a 10-minute break, and I'd sit down, and I'd just read and memorize some scripture. You memorize Psalm 1, start memorizing some Proverbs. And I thought, oh, Ecclesiastes, this is really pretty. I'll try and memorize this. And immediately, I was completely miserable. I can't memorize this. This is horrible. It says everything is meaningless. And that if it had a meaning, you couldn't find it. But you can't find it because there is no meaning. And that's probably the experience that most of you have had reading through the book of Ecclesiastes, if you've even done so. Mm-hmm. Most people avoid it like the plague, right? The only thing more awkward to teach or preach on than Ecclesiastes is also... It's also written by Solomon. It's the Song of Solomon, right? That could be a little awkward sometimes to teach or preach through that one. Although that's another one of my very, very favorite books of the Old Testament. And I wanted to try and understand, why does Solomon write the book of Ecclesiastes? It really doesn't seem to fit the Bible. It's not like the prophets. It's certainly not like the Pentateuch. It's not like the Psalms. It sometimes feels a little bit like Proverbs, but it's a very depressing version of Proverbs. It's not anything like the Gospels or Acts. Certainly not like Paul or Peter or Timothy. It's as strange as Revelation, right? But it doesn't have the happy ending that Revelation... Well, happy ending for some people in Revelation, right? So I just started reading it over and over and over again. I taught the book of Hebrews... at my church, and I taught for 4 years. I took 4 entire years to go through Hebrews. I'm slightly slower than John MacArthur. So I went through the whole book of Hebrews, and the way I prepped to do that was the summer before, I read the book of Hebrews 3 times a day for 100 days. I read it 300 times before I would be felt like, okay, now I think I have the text imprinted enough, I can go in and I can preach through Hebrews. Ecclesiastes... It seems like the more you read it, the more miserable you become. And I found that incredibly fascinating. Like people who really like Russian novels or enjoy reading Nietzsche or watching certain kinds of dark movies or television shows or film noir from the 1940s. Or, you know, there's that kind of music that's real depressive, like Béla Bartók or certain Beethoven pieces, like the second movement of the Seventh Symphony or something like that. But after a while, I started to realize, wait a minute, this book is actually doing something to me. It's completely changing my outlook on life and how I live. And there are all these very famous, beautiful passages like chapter 3. Everyone knows chapter 3. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. Put your hand up if you have the song in your head. You know the song I'm talking about, right? You guys must know that song. Turn, 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 right, from the Birds, right? That is, they take the lyrics of the song and they turn it into this great pop, kind of folk pop song, right? It's had a tremendous influence on culture. And then this image of there's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink that he should make, and that he should make his soul glad and enjoy good in his labor. This I saw that it was from the hand of God. Eat, drink, tomorrow we die. That kind of thing. But the more I read this, the more I realized that this is not a random set of depressing proverbs, which is what many, many people think it is. I actually think it is one of the most uplifting things you can read, and I think that the church as a whole and Christians individually will be radically changed if you make a serious study of the book of Ecclesiastes. There is a line in chapter 1, verse 13, where Solomon says, I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under the sun. And I think that that's one of the keys at the beginning of the book of Proverbs. He wants to dedicate his heart to use wisdom to search out and to study and to understand wisely everything done under heaven. It's the main image of the book. Everything under the sun. Everything under the heavens. In other words, the guy majored in everything. What is he not going to study? What is he not going to try and figure out? What is he not going to try and experience other than things that are clearly sinful? And then after the semicolon, it says this. This severe travail. I've got an old King James Bible. I'm not a King James only guy, but I think it's just a beautiful translation. This severe travail. That means really, 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 really hard work. Travail is the word they would use for a woman in the last stages of labor. So it's like this severe labor, this incredibly difficult work. God has given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. And the way that I understand that is this. God said, here's Eden, Adam. And on top of that, here's Eve. Look at her. I'm going to put you in dominion over everything I've created. It's yours. And Adam said, fine, I'm also going to disobey and take one more little thing that you've said I can't take. The only thing you said that I couldn't have. God says, all right, now you live in a fallen world. A world that is deeply disturbed, deeply damaged, deeply destroyed, painful, terrifying, dangerous, simultaneously appears cyclical and random, and therefore doubly unfair, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. A world that will make absolutely no sense to a mind that cannot make sense of things that make sense. So your mind that can't make sense of things that make sense will be living in a world that makes no sense. And everything will be meaningless and futile and vain. And you will live, whether a short time or a long time, a life of pain and insecurity and doubt and fear and suffering and injustice. And the job I'm giving to you is to try and sort it out without me. Since you've decided to say no to the one command I gave you in paradise. And when I started to understand that verse 13 of chapter 1 was the key to the book, and I started to read through the rest of it, everything else began to fall into place. And it completely changed my perspective on what it means to live fallen in a fallen world. So we're going to talk, I think, twice tomorrow and once on Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you a kind of a quick jet tour of how that fits together with the book of Ecclesiastes. And it's not depressing. It's actually incredibly encouraging and exciting and beautiful.
Well, thank you. I know that this will probably be something that many of you have not heard preached on. And I hope that you will look forward maybe tomorrow morning as you have a chance before we come together for our meeting at 9:30. Maybe take a few moments to read through Ecclesiastes and prepare your hearts. And, you know, I know for retreats our intention and goal is to have a relaxing time, but it also really is to make the most of the opportunity to learn. And, you know, we're at a beautiful place. We have a really wonderful opportunity, I think, not only to enjoy the setting that we've been given, but also just the chance to learn. And I think this particular subject, the book of Ecclesiastes, hopefully will be one that will really, really challenge you and encourage you. Well, thank you. Thank you, Grant. And we'll look forward to tomorrow. I'm just going to close with a few announcements.